He's about 455 yards away. He's going to hit about a 2-iron, I think.
This is the School of Motion podcast. Come for the MoGraph, stay for the puns.
Part of me says, yeah, we should have a style. And then the other part of me says, it's nice because the whole studio is kind of based off this curiosity. We've always wanted to kind of like push ourselves and learn more things and look at different things. And you've kind of almost got that craft element as well, where you're just trying things and seeing what works and what doesn't. So yeah, part of me is thinking, oh, it would be great to have a style. But then the other part of me is thinking, would we just get bored with it? Would it get to that point where you're like, oh yeah, we're just, you know, knocking out another render that looks a certain way and that's all that we're churning out. And so yeah, I kind of like having the no style and being able to push different things and try things.
Well, hello there, friend. How long I've waited here for you. And today I have some really cool guests on the podcast. You see, all my life I've been searching for something. Something never comes, never leads to nothing. But my guests today, well, you might describe them as a one-way motorway. All right, I will stop with the Foo Fighters lyrics. I'm sorry. I can't help it because today we've got Emlyn and Josh from Bomper Studio in Wales, and they have recently released two fully animated music videos for the Foo Fighters. I mean, good God, talk about a dream project. Imagine Dave Grohl asking you to make some weird stuff in Cinema 4D with the Foo Fighters playing on it. What would you say? You'd say yes. And that's exactly what Bomper said. And then they proceeded to make two very different and very cool videos for the songs No Son of Mine and Chasing Birds. In this interview, we dig into how the studio ended up getting the projects and how they ended up with the skill set necessary to pull them off. Bomper is an example of what can happen when a studio is very intentional about the work they want to do. And there's a lot to learn from these two. So come on down and waste away with me, and let's meet Emlyn and Josh from Bomper Studio right after we hear from one of our amazing School of Motion alumni.
Before School of Motion, I used to try to do YouTube tutorials or read articles and teach myself, and it just was not happening. And now, after just one course, I can honestly say that I have a good grasp of what I'm doing in After Effects. So thank you so much, School of Motion. I can't wait to see what the next course brings to me. My name is Lisa Marie Grillos, and I am a School of Motion alumni.
Emlyn and Josh, it is really cool to have you on the School of Motion podcast to talk about your Foo Fighters music videos. This is awesome. Thank you both for coming on.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us, yeah.
Yeah, well, thank you guys. So, Emlyn, I wanted to start with you. So you're the founder of Bomper Studio. And by the way, before we go any further, I need to know about the name. What does Bomper mean?
Well, yeah, it comes from a kind of derogatory term that we used to use as I was growing up as a kid. And it kind of means big and chunky. So if you saw a child, like, you know, a little baby, and you go, "Oh, what a bomper." It just means kind of chunky. And that's where that came from. And it was something that we could own as a name because of this. It's quite unique. So it kind of just fitted.
That's so funny. So, okay, is there like a personal connection to that word, or you just like
yeah,
the word?
Yeah, it was just used in the, because we're in South Wales in the valleys, it was just like a valleys term, like a valleyism that we used to use growing up.
So if I say bomper in London, they may not know what I'm talking about.
No, they would got
it. No one will understand.
Yeah. Good to know. Awesome. Okay, so Bomper has been around for several years now, and you guys have done a lot of amazing work, but I'm always curious to hear how people get into the field. So maybe you could just sort of briefly like take us through your history. How did you get into the field of 3D animation and end up doing this for a living?
Yeah, of course I can. I started when I left university. I got picked up by Cadbury Design Studio, which is now called Mondelez. So they make chocolate bars and all delicious stuff.
Cadbury eggs. It's my favorite.
Yeah, exactly. So I was taken on with them as a CG artist. And I worked there as a freelancer for about 10 years. And then I needed to move back to South Wales because that was in Birmingham in England. And then when I moved back, there wasn't that much work in terms of CG animation in this area. So it was either kind of commute quite a distance to London for a couple of job offers that I'd had. But ultimately, I've always wanted to start my own studio. So I just got pushed into it, essentially. There was nothing around, so I gave it a go. And luckily enough, right where we moved, there was like a business incubation center called Welsh Ice. And I just went there, met the founder at the time, there, which was Gareth Jones. and just really hit it off. It was a brilliant place to start a business. You know, you had a year's free of internet, a desk, a telephone. So it really felt like starting a business. You know, you felt like you had somewhere to go. So that's how, you know, Bump started. It was just me at a desk, and then it steadily grew. Brought in a couple of staff, and then I think Josh was third in the door.
Yeah, I was a third in.
Yeah, and he's been with us ever since.
So you said that you freelanced for 10 years.
Yes.
So why was that? Was that because you wanted to freelance, or was it just because out of necessity, that's sort of how your clients were used to using you? I mean, were you ever looking for a full-time gig?
It was kind of called permalancing because it was, you know, I was one place for a couple of years, and then it was kind of lucky because it was almost like a day job, but then I could work out of hours as long as it wasn't direct competitors. I could work with other places. So I ended up working with different studios and different, you know, brands. As long as they were outside the confectionery business, I could work with them. So yeah, I kind of made quite a nice portfolio of clients. And that was the kind of jumping off point then to when I started up the studio. It was kind of like I had almost like a portfolio to show, almost like, yeah, like a legacy portfolio.
Yeah. Well, that's what I was kind of wondering, because freelancing can almost be like training wheels for running a studio, because you have to do all of the same things. You have to market yourself and do client service and actually do the work. So when you started the studio, did it feel like a natural progression, or was there still this really steep learning curve?
It was still a really steep learning curve. The scariest bit is employing somebody.
But sure.
That initial one was the scariest thing at the start, because you know that person's relying on you to either pay their mortgage or their rent or whatever. And, you know, you think, oh my God, can we afford this person? Can we, you know, that was like the initial scary bit. And obviously you just got to kind of generate work. So you will literally take anything at the start, you know, whatever is coming to you, you will, you know, yeah, we can do that. We can do this.
Yeah. So looking at Bumper's, you know, current work, I mean, a lot of it looks like full-blown 3D pipeline making, you know, like, you know, fully polished 3D films, essentially.
Yeah.
Was that what you were doing as a freelancer? Because, you know, to me, it's, and just so you have some context, my experience with 3D is very much on like the MoGraphy kind of abstract 3D side. I haven't done the kind of work that Bumper typically does. And so I've always been that generalist where like I'm modeling and lighting and texturing and rendering and anime, doing all of it. And the kind of stuff that you're doing, I find typically studios have pipelines and much bigger like staff.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But if you're freelance, what was your role while you were freelancing?
I was a generalist. So it was literally do everything essentially. So every place that I worked, it was more or less, you know, you draw the storyboard, you build the assets, you make the animation, you know, and a lot of it was more motion graphics based. It was either, you know, product reveals or it was launches, that kind of stuff. Sometimes we would do the odd, you know, asset for TVCs and a lot of most of my background was still images. So, you know, a lot of retouching, a lot of that kind of high end advertising campaign stuff. So coming into animation, I have a huge passion for animation, but at the time of starting the studio, I didn't have a load of experience of it, you know, and actually creating it. So we've developed, you know, insanely over the last 7 years. The studio's going to be going 7 years, but if you look at from where we started to where we are today, yeah, that pipeline is completely different. You know, we've learned so much, and Josh could probably jump on in this section as well, where I think it was about 2 years ago, we did our own in-house production, which was called Coffee Run. Mm. And this was Josh's, you know, so I opened the floor up to everybody in the studio at the time and said that this is where we want to go with character animation. We didn't know too much about the kind of pipeline and what we needed to do and how to set things up. So I set a brief for, it was supposed to be a 30-second character piece. And then it turned up into Coffee Run, which is about 2 minutes, 10 seconds, I think, at the minute. So yeah, if you want to jump onto that, Josh.
Yeah, it was we'd done a bit of animation. So I joined early on as like a storyboard artist, essentially, because I think it was a very early Bumper animation job for a corporate client, and I jumped on there. So we were always doing animation, but we never really approached like full character animation. And then we got an opportunity to work with BBC Bite Size. Making like educational films for the BBC that required character animation, and that kind of forced us to like level up a little bit and learn terms that we didn't know. Like, we didn't know what a block or a spline pass or anything was, like stuff animators say to each other. We were literally, it was just four or five generalists just sitting there, really. Generalists to different extents. Like, we all had like our main skills, but we could all do essentially a version of everything that we were doing. So after that BBC job, yeah, we looked at ways that we could kind of push our character stuff further and pitched this idea for Coffee Run, which is like a little like slapstick, like silent film almost, about a guy trying to make like a round of coffee in the studio. And it's essentially, it's just like slapstick pratfalls and physical comedy stuff. Cause I thought that would be like a really good testing ground. One character, one environment, and a load of props that we can make from scratch.
Let me dig in here a little bit. This is, I didn't realize this. This is really fascinating to me because I've done a little bit of character animation in my career, not very much. And it's always, I think with one exception, been in After Effects. Right. And to me, the process of doing character animation is very different than the process of doing a logo reveal or some, you know, one shot journey with like, you know, a stroke animating on or something. You're following it through the brand. I've done that stuff. And the process is, I don't know, there's just, it's so much more technical. And there's just things that in character animation, you have, they're just way more important, like the silhouette of the character and exaggerating the poses. And even the process of doing pose to pose animation and blocking things out and then doing a spline pass, that doesn't really exist in sort of normal motion designy things. And when I look at your work, there's no sign of, okay, you figured this out. Like, you know, like I taught at a school for a year, the Ringling College of Art and Design. They have a character animation program, basically. It's called computer animation, but it's essentially like a character animation major. And people spend 4 years practicing this stuff to be able to do it. So I'd love to hear what it was like to try and pull that off, not being quote unquote character animators.
Yeah, it was all like self-initiated. So, you know, it was all funded. We didn't get any funding for it. It was just something that, like I said, I have a passion for animation, but we at the time we didn't know, especially the pipeline, and we use Cinema 4D as well. So it's not heavily regarded as a character piece of software. So we just reached out to people. So rigging, you know, is insanely technical. Mm-hmm. So we reached out to people. We flew over Gene, who he came over for 2 weeks to help us out with rigging. And then
Gene
he taught
McToto.
Alan. Yeah, Gene McToto. And then we brought over Gary Abrahart as well. He did some training as well with us. And it was just reaching out to everybody that we knew that who could do these certain things and show us how to build rigs and what we needed, because we needed as well, we were fortunate we had Alan Toundrow, who was the animator at the time. And he had a good lot of experience with rigs and what the rigs needed to be able to do to express the motion, you know, the emotions and like you said, the silhouette and what we wanted to push. So I think it's making sure that we give people enough time and, you know, they've got the expertise. I know that, you know, Alan's better at animating than I am. So that you always default to what they're feeding back to you. And that's how we did it. We, you know, we just learned a lot. I don't think we did any client work for like 2 months. At one point, we just dropped all client work so we could just figure this stuff out.
And if you were to look at the pipeline now compared to the pipeline, certainly when we were doing the initial BBC Bite Size stuff, which was a mix of what you were talking about with the After Effects. There was some 2D episodes, which were these After Effects rigs, which was what we were more comfortable with, I think, or had a bit more experience doing, even though it's not CG. And then, these fully fledged CG animations. If you look at the way our pipeline was organized back then compared to now, it's like every job we do, really, it just gets a little bit more streamlined. And I think I think a little bit more specific in terms of why everyone's individual tasks are as well. Because it was a studio of generalists doing what they could, really, at a certain point. But like Emlyn said, you bring in experts and rely on them and suddenly it takes a bit more shape.
That's really cool. I mean, I guess it's almost a testament also to the tools, because they've gotten so much more accessible that, you know, I think 10 years ago to be a generalist, it may not include character animation because it definitely was a specialty. And now it seems like more and more artists are just adding that to the list of things that they can do. That's really, really cool. And Josh, I'm curious specifically how you develop these skills, because on LinkedIn, it says you went to school for film and television, which ironically, that's the exact same degree I have.
Nice.
And you know, and in my program anyway, it was very focused on like production and how you do shoots and how cameras work. And then a little bit of editing.
Yeah.
There was no 3D animation and there wasn't any After Effects really. So how did you develop these skills? There certainly wasn't design training. So I'm curious how you ended up doing this.
Yeah, it was a lot of the university course. It was a lot of practical, like live action filmmaking with kind of the equipment of the day. And then it was, editing, which is something I did, you know, I tried to do as much of as I could. So that was probably the main thing from that course that I brought over, and kind of academic study of films and stuff. So there was no design element or anything. But luckily, in making the short films and stuff for that course, I did a lot of storyboard work. And I'm kind of not trained as an artist, but I can draw a little bit. So I did some storyboard work there, and I luckily had just started properly making comics just before I had like a job interview at Bumper. So I had like a portfolio of like comic book work that I'd done that I still do. So I had, those are my skills really. I didn't have anything else. Like I could edit and I could draw a little bit. And then when we actually got on the job, because it was, like I say, it was a storyboarding position primarily. And then I kind of just picked a lot of stuff up in that early job.
You have that freakishly knack of just learning stuff instantly, like you've just downloaded it.
Yeah, I got Matrix. I got those Matrix cassettes of Cinema 4D. So yeah, I mean, really, I can use cinema and I can use the stuff we use, but I wouldn't be like a standalone. You know, I don't think I would survive as a generalist. I got a good grasp of it. After Effects was kind of what I mainly used early on, and we still use After Effects for probably more compositing than we should really at this stage. But yeah, we use After Effects for a lot of stuff. Mm-hmm. And that was there from like the first couple of weeks. And then, yeah, gradually getting more involved into cinema. And the directing element of it, that stuff does tie back to the film and video stuff really, because even though once you understand the pipeline, and there's a much different like logistical element to it where you're dealing with a lot more people, and getting something ready for animation requires a lot more like forethought than just going out with a camera, you know, even if you've got a tight script. But actually, you know, structuring stuff and making sure the tone is right, that those are all kind of transferable skills from film and from comics and stuff. So
Right. Well, so you just said, it was like an offhanded comment. You said we're probably doing more compositing in After Effects than we should at this point. I'm curious what you meant by that. Are you talking about like trying to get more in the render versus making it look that way afterwards?
Well, I don't know how much we want to slag After Effects off, really. On you. I've been burnt because we do a lot of great stuff in After Effects. What's good for After Effects for me is that there's a real like organic flow from storyboarding to finished render. So in everything we do, essentially, what I'll do is I'll cut the storyboard in Premiere, convert that into After Effects comps. Each shot is his own comp. And then all you're doing then is instead of like a big edit at the end, just slowly populating this After Effects project mm-hmm. with finished shots. So you're a really good view of how things work, like light, you know, you're not waiting for assembly edits. You kind of, you're always seeing it. But where we did a lot with post, like CryptoMap passes, stuff, EXRs.
Right.
And we ran up into a bit of a tech war really with like, it's not really designed for that. It can do it, but it's not designed to run that stuff smoothly. So we're looking at a workflow where maybe we use After Effects as the final compile pass. And we actually put these shots individually together, maybe in something else. It served us well for 7 years.
Have you looked at Nuke or Fusion or anything like that?
Yeah, it would be one of those two. We're just doing some R&D really to figure out which is the best route for us.
That's cool. So let's talk a little bit about, I guess the word style. So Bumper's most recent work, I mean, it's character driven, which I think I kind of want to like just note that for everyone listening, because it's really interesting that's it doesn't sound like that's where you started. And it was a mm-hmm. conscious decision to do a studio project to get you there. And look, it worked. and there's something cool, I think, about just being very intentional about it, taking time off from client work to do the work that you would like someone to pay you for before they're actually paying you to do it. So that's really cool. But how do you think about having a house style? Because some, especially 3D animation studios, sometimes they kind of get known for a certain look or a certain sensibility.
Yeah.
And your work's very varied. So I can't really pin any specific thing down. Is that on purpose, or would you like to have a style that you're known for, or do you even care?
Yeah, I don't know. Part of me says, yeah, we should have a style. And then the other part of me says, it's nice because the whole studio is kind of based off this curiosity. We've always wanted to kind of like push ourselves and learn more things and look at different things. And you've kind of almost got that craft element as well, where you're just trying things and seeing what works and what doesn't. So yeah, we're really close to Aardman as well, which is just over the bridge from us. And obviously they have a highly recognizable style. Mm-hmm. So yeah, part of me is thinking, oh, it would be great to have a style. But then the other part of me is thinking, would we just get bored with it? Would it get to that point where we're like, oh yeah, we're just, you know, knocking out another render that looks a certain way and that's all that we're churning out. And so yeah, I kind of like having the no style and being able to push different things and try things.
It lets you really commit as well to like a film. So like if we had a house style and we were like slavish towards that style, then there's no way that that style would have been established like 4 years ago as being like a toon shaded yellow submarine sort of throwback thing, you know? So not having something that we're kind of restricted by allows us to like jump first into these jobs.
Yeah.
You know, if we were trying to make this film, the latest Foo Fighters film, look like Coffee Run, say, not to say it wouldn't be good, but it'd be an entirely different thing, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. There's other things to consider, like obviously budget and what the brief is. Obviously we had a set brief of what the band wanted for the last one. And it's a little bit different with the No Sun. That was, a completely different style, but they wanted this edgier style. And so, yeah, we get just to pitch on it and see what comes of that initial brief. I think that's the difference with us. We don't have a set style.
Yeah. It seems like it could be a double-edged sword, you know, like you get mm-hmm. known for something and then that's great because you can get really, really good at it and build a pipeline around that. But also as a business, it's probably easier if you can mm-hmm. kind of be a generalist as a studio mm-hmm. too. So I want to get into the Foo Fighters video, but real quick, I do want to find out kind of what your pipeline looks like. And I'm curious about the use of Cinema 4D. I think there's this sort of lingering feeling that just is not true anymore, but like maybe 15 years ago, Cinema 4D was kind of weaker on the character animation side and everyone used Maya or something else like that. And so I think that there's still just kind of a lingering effect of mm-hmm. most character pipelines don't include Cinema 4D, but yours does. I'm curious mm-hmm. how you've found that to be, and then sort of what are the other pieces in the pipeline?
Yeah, well, it's like I said, my background was Cinema 4D, so obviously I'm going to lean towards that, and that's how this company started. So that was always going to be the one that I wanted to push because I know it, and you know, I'm getting on now, so it's going to be hard to learn new stuff. So that was the basis from it. But I knew that it could do a certain amount. There's the character tools that they're not amazing, but you can get something really quick out and you can do some really nice work with it. And again, it's all about cutting shots as well. You can hide so much nowadays, but with nice shots and just, you know, thinking of ways of getting around the issues. But like I said, when we did Coffee Run, we just brought in specialists so that we could try and find who we thought was the best rigging around who, you know, we brought in animators that they were using Maya. So they had to relearn how to do this stuff in cinema. And we had issues. And I remember speaking to Rick and a few other people at Maxon just saying, like, you know, this is not working. How can you help us? What can we do? And we had a couple of meetings with those and they were amazing. Arrestus was amazing. Just, you know, showing us different things that we could use, different plugins. So yeah, that's how we built the pipeline off cinema, is just by creating as much as we could from it, getting plugins. We had a couple of scripts as well, but that's how that started. And then in terms of the rest of the pipeline, as Josh said, we use After Effects for the compositing. And then we bolt on stuff if we need simulations, we do some Houdini. Mm. It's pretty rare because obviously they take a lot of time. We've done a little bit. I'm trying to think, ZBrush.
Yeah, ZBrush for characters, don't we? And we use mm-hmm. Substance, we tend to use quite a lot, which wasn't, you know, it's a fairly new addition last couple of years. I say new, it's been at least 2 years. Yeah. But, you know.
I don't think we've used it on the last couple of projects, though, I don't think.
I think we used it a little bit, yeah, because we were hand drawing over the characters, and I think we ran into issues doing that straight onto it. I think Colin had to do like a Substance pass, and then I inked onto his Substance pass.
Okay.
But it has been quite, yeah, Substance has been good. ZBrush has been good. Cinema, I think, yeah, like you said, it's there are little quirks to it. Mm. And I can see why, if you were an established studio using something, it's not, you know, you kind of use what you know. And I think because we were so generalist focused, it did allow like a lot of artists to jump in and help on shots in a way that they wouldn't be able to if we were siloing off, you know, even if we were doing the animation in something else and then bringing that into cinema for final passes, there are downfalls to that workflow as well.
Right.
So there are little weird things with it, but everything we've attempted to do, we've managed to do. You know, we've never had a shot and said, oh, we could do that if we had Blender or Maya going, but we're not going to try it because we're in cinema. Like everything we've attempted, we've pulled off.
Yeah. And what, you know, I mean, there's, I still think we're kind of towards the tail end of the render wars here. What renderers are you guys using these days?
We tried everything, honestly. when we first started, we were using V-Ray. So for the first year or two, we were using V-Ray for everything. But that, like I said, that was a lot of product stuff. And then I think it was about the second year in, Octane had come around. And we found, we just kind of went all out and put all our eggs in one basket and bought, you know, water-cooled GPU machines and stuff to just, because we could see the benefit of being able to render across a network, especially when it came to still images. You know, we get in work out in almost seconds, you know, so that's a huge time save, especially when you're doing lighting passes, or if you're, you know, you're just trying to get a reflection where you want it to, you know, make it as pretty as possible. So being able to art direct it almost in real time was a huge benefit. So a lot of the stuff that we use now is Octane, but we've just started using Arnold as well because we wanted to try the toon shading.
Oh, that's cool. Okay, well, let's talk about the toon shading stuff, and I think it's a good segue to get into the Foo Fighters videos that you've done. And so, everybody listening, we're going to link to everything we talk about in the show notes. Definitely watch the videos. They're really cool. And if you're a Foo Fighters fan, the songs are both really great. Actually, the newer video, the Chasing Birds, it's very unlike most of their music. I actually really dug it. But, you know, I'm a huge Foo Fighter fan. I'm really a Dave Grohl fan. But so that makes me a Foo Fighters fan. So I'm curious, I don't know if you two are, but what was it like the day that somehow you were asked to do a Foo Fighters video?
I'll jump in. It's surreal, I got to be honest. We've done some work with the record label, which is RCA. So the work we did for Tyler Childers was with them. And then, yeah, just the record label just sent me an email, and it just said Foo Fighters in the title. And then in the body, the copy text, it would just say, call me. And that was it. And I genuinely thought it was a joke. That was it, though. It was amazing.
That's so funny. And okay, so they came to you, obviously. I mean, I don't know if they already had the concept in their mind, but did they come to you because they saw character work on your reel?
So the first thing we did for RCA was music video for Tyler Childers, Country Squire, which we did with, we art directed and we did the production, but it was directed by Tony Moore, the cartoonist who did co-created The Walking Dead.
Who Josh was a massive fanboy of as well. Of,
yeah.
That's great.
So we did that. So they knew we could do it. And that was kind of like a pretty intense project with a tight turnaround. And it was quite ambitious. And that was Octane. That was actually Octane standard, path tracing stuff. So we had that. And then we did some other work off to the side. And then, they came back to us because I think, A, they were happy with how that video came out. And B, they knew we had the potential to turn things around in a kind of shorter time frame than is ideal.
Humanly possible.
At Christmas time.
I love this though, because again, it kind of gets back to that thing of, you know, you decided to make Coffee Run to sort of push the studio's ability to do character stuff. And it sounds like you invested a lot in that, you know, in terms of not taking on client work and then bringing on, and I'm assuming paying freelancers that you knew to come even train you and train your staff. And then down the road, that turns into your ability to do a video for Country Star, which then turns into two Foo Fighters music videos. Mm-hmm. And I just think for everyone listening, this is kind of a really important lesson. Every single artist and studio, I think, that's been on this podcast that has done super cool things, there's always this weird set of dominoes that had to fall to make that happen. But the first domino is intentionally placed by the artist or the studio every time. It's almost never an accident. So let's talk about No Son of Mine, because I think the story behind that's a little different than Chasing Birds. So that was the first video. Tell me about sort of the, you know, what did they say when they came to you, the record label, and what were they looking for?
Yeah, they came to us and basically they were in a bit of like a conundrum, because they were planning to do a live action video, and obviously the world was not allowing them to do that at the time. So they were like, we need it to be out for this date, and we have, you know, what can you do for us? And we kind of had a little chat, and actually Dave had had some ideas previously about a live action video that were like sent to us in the form of like a print screen of a WhatsApp conversation. So like that, we had like a WhatsApp convo print screen that was like our Bible, and then it was like, right, okay, let's do this, let's try and figure out a way to animate this and work in some stuff that they had managed to shoot that was intended for another purpose, and kind of treat that stuff so it fits the vibe of the animated stuff we were doing.
Gotcha. Okay. So I was going to ask about that, because that video is a mix of live action footage that's heavily treated and then fully CG shots. So the concept initially was, this is just a live action shoot. And then they sort of said, okay, we can't do that anymore because of COVID. Let's do a 3D, you know, let's add some animation to it. So where did the concept for the video come from? I mean, there's sort of like a storyline to it.
So that storyline is what, that was the kind of main thing that we got from that WhatsApp conversation. It was Dave kind of, I don't know what time it was, but it was clearly him having an idea and just sending it in, like, as he did the thing where like you send 10 messages and no response until the end, because it's like sending so fast. So that kind of outlined pretty much the whole plot, except for the specifics of how we were going to like tell the story. And then we did have some notes about kind of look, not specifically about this animated stuff, because it was kind of open, I think. I can't fully remember, but I got a feeling like that was suggested as something we could do, but they weren't married to that, but it sounded good to us. So we kind of went that way. Yeah, we also got like some look test footage from Dave when he was in a shoot for something else, where he was messing around with like iPhone filters, and he found one that was like his face. It made him really like, it was a stark, it looked like that kind of Sin City look.
Yeah, it's like a sketchbook, wouldn't it? Sketchbook style.
So let's go for that then. Let's try and do a high end version of that, because that kind of fits the story, and I think we can do something cool with the look of the animated stuff to tie it all together. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they'd shot a lot of stuff for the Jimmy Kimmel show. And then, Dave was just sending these messages where, like, part of it was really like the idea of this first-person perspective of seeing this person, a bit like the Smack My Bitch Up, which is the Prodigy song.
Yep.
And they wanted to kind of do something similar along the lines of that. We follow this person and they, you know, goes through a wild night of debauchery. And that was the kind of premise for it.
Yeah. So let's talk about the look of this one. So I was going to say Sin City. I mean, that's what it reminded me of with, you know, it's black and white. It's very, very high contrast. And then there's a spot color, which in this case is green, which is a really cool choice. But what one of the most interesting things, I think, technically is like the textures in it. You've, you know, in the 3D characters, there's almost this engraving kind of texture over everything. Mm-hmm. And it's very, very specific. So I'm curious, like, you know, if this was being done for an ad agency, you'd probably have like three options, and then they'd noodle on one for a while, and you'd have to show them style frames and mood boards and all this. But you're working with a band, you're working with an artist. So is the process any different to kind of throw ideas at them?
No, we were open to pitch. So obviously we'd had this really rough brief, and then the label, like, okay, what can you do? Obviously the time frames were really short. It was over a Christmas period as well. So we had a really short window of production. So it was a case of like, what can you do? How can you do it? And then when we, you know, the studio just got together, like, how can we do this in a way that we can physically get out? How much can we do, first of all? How many minutes of animation can we do? Because we didn't think we could do the entire, I think it was like 3.5 minutes, Josh, is it 4 minutes, something like that?
Yeah.
So we realized we couldn't do that as a piece. Especially as a character piece. So we were like, how could we potentially use the style that we'd come up with and then use that on the live action as well to try and integrate them? And then partly from the style, so that character, the kind of wood block cut effect, that originated from some work that I saw from Thomas Shahan. And he's an artist in the US, in Oklahoma. And I think I found his work on Sketchfab, I think it was. And I just loved the style of it. So I messaged him, asked him, you know, if he'd come on board to design the characters for us. And yeah, he was happy to do it. So a bit of a win, honestly.
Yeah, and that stuff looks really good, like the texture on the guy's face. I think when we were looking at it, we looked at Sin City, obviously, like that was like the kind of easy landmark for us to like guide people to. But I'm like surrounded by walls and walls of comics here, so I had lots of like black and white stuff to reference. And there's like a good Argentinian series called Alex Sinner, which is like kind of what everyone claims Frank Miller ripped off for Sin City. And that stuff had like, it's got a lot more lines in the faces and in like sort of the whites. And I was trying to do stuff like that myself for it. And luckily it dovetailed with Thomas's stuff because it looked much, much better than what we were trying to do. Looked much, much, much better. So it was really like lucky timing.
So on a technical level, was there any part of this that was like really hard to pull off? I mean, you know, when I look at it, the textures and just sort of getting things to line up correctly on the geometry, that seems like would probably be tricky. But I noticed little details, like there are some parts of shots that look more photoreal. There's a church scene where the floor of the church has reflections and, you know, lots of texture to it, but then the character still looks fairly flat. You know, was any of this sort of a big technical challenge to overcome, or did you just kind of brute force stuff?
It's a bit of a saying, isn't it? We have a character that we've designed, well, we've made up. It's called Bruce Forte.
I love that.
When we go, you know, sometimes we're in a production, we're like, we've just got to Bruce this and go all out for it.
I'm going to steal that. It's brilliant.
That's Josh's character.
Yeah, I'll design him one day. Yeah, it was, it's a thing of like, you start with a character and we've got this look, and yeah, it was kind of character, maybe like a start environment that was kind of what we got signed off as like this, okay, this is the approach we're going down. But then when you get into the nitty gritty, that's only when you really realize things need to be tweaked slightly. So yeah, there were little battles with ourselves, really, like trying to figure out what was the best way to show maybe the more complicated environments, like the church and maybe some of the bar, you know, because it's that one color, black and white, it can be really hard to render complex environments like that. But luckily we had Rod and Zach, who work at the studio. They both were kind of like coming up with cool ways to light these shots within the Octane Tomb render with a little bit of Fetlin. So yeah, we have some reflections here. Maybe there's a couple of shots where we thought it worked best if maybe we use like a diffuse material in the background instead of like a blank white. But yeah, they really pulled it out of the bag. It was great.
And that was kind of one of the reasons we used that style, is because obviously because it's dark scenes, you can hide a lot, you know, because we had short timelines. We want to be able to do this character animation, but obviously sometimes you have to just, like I said, cut her in a way or shoot her in a way to be able to hide some of the more complex stuff. And so, yeah, that was partly the reason as well. It was just timelines.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the editorial style really helps you out too, because you can jump around and the camera's shaking, and you can probably hide a lot of the sin that way.
Yeah, a lot of the sin. Yeah.
So let's talk about the next video, which, you know, I think No Son of Mine. I mean, and again, everybody listening should go, you know, look at the show notes and watch the video. It's really a great example, I think, of working within a limitation, right? You have this footage, I apparently wasn't even meant for this, but you don't have enough and it's not stylized. And so, I mean, the way that you treated the footage, the textures you overlaid on it, but then you use those same textures on top of the CG to tie it together, is really very clever. Now, the next video that you did for the Foo Fighters, Chasing Birds, completely different beast. And frankly, I mean, if I didn't know that the same studio had done it, I never would have guessed. I mean, it really is like, it looks totally different. I immediately got Yellow Submarine vibes from it, from the song and the video. So how did this video come about? I mean, were they just so thrilled with No Son of Mine and they just, you know, you didn't have to pitch this time. They just, Dave WhatsApps you and says, hey, Emlyn, let's do it.
Again, yeah, we were in discussion. We were just finishing off No Son, and then while we were in a Zoom call, you know, the label just said, oh, we do have another one that would be cool that you might want to look at. And again, yeah, it was just the brief was we like the Yellow Submarine vibe. We, you know, this is the song. We got shared the song before it was released, so that's always cool.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, we listened to it like, wow, there's so much we could do with this. Hmm. And we had a bit of a longer lead time as well. So we were trying to get No Sun finished, and then we were also trying to then, you know, do some look development and a treatment to figure out how this, you know, Chasing Birds was going to look.
So what was that process like, the look development part? I mean, were you doing like paintings at that point and sketches, style frames, mood boards, or were you already like, all right, let's play around with a tune renderer and see what we can get?
We were doing some sketches at the start. Yeah, it kind of started with concept sketches and an idea. So we had Yellow Submarine as like the benchmark at the start, but it was a much more open brief really than No Sun. We didn't have like a plot outline or anything handed over. So it was really like left to our own devices as long as it fit inside that world. So we did like some character sketches of like how the characters would look. We did some like environment plate sketches and wrote up some like a little treatment together, and we sent all that stuff over, and pretty much with a bit of like guiding, it's not that stuff that we initially sent over isn't a million miles away from what we actually did. It kind of looks and plays fairly similarly to that initial pitch, which is quite good.
Yeah, there was a key visual that we had on the treatment that we sent over, and the band and the label and the management just kind of picked that out, and they said, yeah, that's what we really like. Can we head towards that? So that was like one of the key things out of that. But yeah, in terms of story, it was just an open book. We could do whatever we wanted. The only thing they stipulated is that we couldn't show the band taking any substances, and that was it.
I think they were semi open to it, but I was like, should we avoid it? And they were like, it might be a good idea to avoid it, actually.
I mean, it's heavily implied. So
yeah.
So for anyone who hasn't watched the video yet, I mean, it is really a very psychedelic, you know, everything's kind of wavy and warpy, and there's just weird imagery. It's almost like in Charlie and the Chocolate Factory when they go on that down that boat ride in the fever dream kind of sequence. It's really, really cool. And the other thing is it's incredibly ambitious. So you've got every member of the band. There's six mm-hmm. people fully rendered, rigged, modeled with hair, mm-hmm. but it's stylized. There's lip sync, which I don't think you had in the previous video. So like, just in terms of the ambitiousness of this and trying to get it done in time, like how did you approach it from that standpoint, saying, okay, we've got this big hairy idea and we have this amount of time to get it done. You know, did you have to start thinking about like corners to cut or things like that? Or did you just sort of just pray that it would work out okay?
Yeah, it's a lot of praying. I think because we're doing the story, and we're doing the storyboards, and we're also going to be there. You know, it's not like going to hand this storyboard off and someone's going to do it and then the video will come out. Like, there's never really a thing where we make something that's way too ambitious from the storyboard point, because we're always thinking about, we're going to have to actually do this. So let's not, you know. So I think the thing that was the saving grace for us for this one was it's a long song. It's 4:30, but it's a slow-paced song, you know, and it kind of wants to be a slow-paced video. So, like, in our mind, it's just like, okay, it's 50 shots. If it's 50 shots, we can you know, work to a shot number. And then when it became clear that really we needed the whole band to be in it for it to be what we wanted it to be, it's just a pipeline thing then. It's like, okay, so how many people can we have working and separate elements at the same time to make this efficient? So like, we knew the whole band was going to be in it, so we didn't need to wait until the storyboard was done to start making assets, because it's like, you know, definitely every member of the Foo Fighters is going to be in this and all the instruments. So we can get character artists and prop artists working before the kind of animatic is cut. So that helps us. Same with rigging, really. We knew we needed these rigs that were elastic and kind of free moving, but also, you know, had a lot of like expressiveness in the face. And luckily, it goes back to Coffee Run again, the kind of self-driven project that we had a rig that Alan, our animator, had made for the Coffee Run guy. That is pretty robust and was able to like use for this essentially. So that was an investment well spent.
Yeah. And then we pulled in we found a couple of other riggers as well. So it was just kind of making sure we scaled up to cover the need and to make sure we had the pipeline, the workflow much quicker, so we could get the rigs ready. So that then when brought on character animators, that they were good to go. And then obviously there's always this little bit of time where character animators are feeding back going, oh yeah, his left leg does this weird pop or this happens, or, and there's always this kind of, you know, whittling down, making sure that the rigs are fully robust. But yeah, I remember from the initial brief, we did, I think we said there was just going to be mainly Dave all the way through it. It was going to be, you know, we might see the band members roughly in maybe the rocks and maybe in plants. Yeah. And we weren't going to like do that much with the other characters. And then the feedback was like, could we please have more of the band in it? And we were like, oh, okay, let's see what we can do.
Right. That's so funny. So Josh, I want to ask about the storyboarding process for something like this, because, you know, there's some shots, you know, a bottle lying on the ground, a hand reaches out, where it's pretty clear how you're going to execute that. You know, there's not a lot of questions there. But then there's shots, like there's a shot where I think Dave walks up to this giant heart-shaped rock, and then it cracks into a million pieces, and like liquid bursts through and pushes the rocks around, and he has to run away from it. And there's these like dragons going in and out, or these sort of eel-like things diving in and out of the fluid. And, you know, in your mind, as you're concepting that, are you thinking about the technical challenge that you're signing somebody up for? I guess in the context of like, okay, that shot is going to have to be figured out. And I don't know how long that's going to take.
Well, yeah, some of it is like, I'm going to have to figure that out because I know I'm going to have to work on that shot. But usually those are like the really easy shots. If I've done it, the hard work has been done, basically. So like, luckily, because we're like a close-knit studio, yeah, we've got Alan, who's the kind of lead animator on it. He's not animating every shot. We're bringing in animators who are like amazing to help us out. But he's got a great, you know, sense of like, so there's a shot where like Taylor is falling down like a chasm, and then he goes into Pat's mouth, and then Pat rips his own heads off. And that was storyboarded by, that was like one of the bits I didn't do. This guy, Mark Proctor, was really good. The storyboarded that bit, is amazing. And the storyboard looks really close to the actual final thing as well. So that was a case like, Alan, is this possible? And he's like, yeah, it can be done. So I was like, okay, that's going in. And then, so it's just like checks like that. Colin Wood, who's like our technical director, most of the stuff like to do with liquid or like a band breaking apart would just be like a quick, can this be done call while he's on the middle of it, like doing something else. And he's like, yeah, it can be done. And I said, okay, well, you'll have to figure out how to do it in about 3 weeks time. But like, he sounds confident for now. so yeah, it just helps being able to check with everybody and, you know, get everyone's expertise on it before anything gets sent off. There were like really simple shots in there that we took out because we just realized it would be more of a headache than they were worth. So like, some of my favorite shots in it are like really simple ones where the band is like being shattered apart, and like Pat's head is gluing back together and it's like glowing pink. And I think we had like a really basic like little joke in there where like a couple of the band members had like got each other's arms and they were like swapping arms and stuff. And then it was just like, yeah, we can do that, but it's going to really take us a long, long time for the payoff. So maybe we'll just knock that one on the head.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, at what point, like there was a shot pretty close to the beginning of the video where Taylor, the drummer, and then one of the other band members, their arms start kind of bending and turning into pretzels and stuff like that. And I'm looking at it and I'm thinking, okay, the rig had to be modeled in a way to allow for that to happen. And so it's questions like that always pop into my mind. You know, when you storyboarded that or had that idea, did you then have to go tell the person modeling them, make sure there's enough geometry on the arms or make sure the edge flow works? Because there's this one shot where he ties a knot with his arm.
Well, luckily we knew that was always like in there from the start, really, was that not specifically that framing and that specific shot, but like we want them to be able to bend. And we had in the back of our minds that we had that because the Coffee Run film is all bendy limbs. And we knew we had that rig that could be repurposed. So luckily that was like an early sort of thing that we knew we'd have to do. If we were like halfway through the No Son of Mine video and we're like, it'd be great if his arm could bend like a spaghetti strand, we wouldn't have it. Yeah, we'd be up against the wall. Right, but luckily we knew what we were going into with this, and that was kind of like an early thing.
How tough was it to get the tune shading to work right? I mean, I've done a few projects actually using Sketch and Tune for Cinema 4D, and you know, sometimes you get lucky and it just looks great, but oftentimes, and this is what I'm imagining, getting the outlines and the edges that you want to be to look inked, but not the ones that shouldn't be inked, to really nail that is pretty painful sometimes. So I'm curious how hard it was and how much, you know, sort of how much did Bruce Forte have to get involved?
Bruce Forte was involved from the outset.
He's a key member of the team.
He's always watching.
Yeah, I don't know if Josh said it originally either, but we did start working on this one because we'd done No Sun with Octane, and we're using the tune for that. We started with this one, and then we realized that there was quite a lot of limitations to get those key lines and to get certain, you know, the certain look that we wanted, especially this kind of yellow sub, kind of trippy 1960s psychedelia. So we realized then, okay, well, what else is there? We tried Sketch and Tune. I used Sketch and Tune in the past, and, you know, it used to get me out of a lot of trouble where I designed something fully in cinema, and then somebody go, oh, you know, can I see your sketches? And then I'll, you know, quickly stick a Sketch and Tune on and go, oh, yeah, see, look, it looks so similar. And they're like, wow, yeah, it's really close. So yeah, that got me out of a lot of holes in the past. But again, we were having this issue where just it wasn't quite hitting it. So we just thought, let's give Arnold a try. And then we kind of finessed it over, I think it was about a week. And then, yeah, it just stood out to be the right one. But then there was other considerations, like every time we were building a rig, that rig had to have, you know, custom settings inside it to make sure that, you know, when it was at a certain distance away from the camera, we could adjust things. So the line weights and things like that. So we were kind of almost hand crafting it for every shot to make sure that, you know, the line weights were right in that shot, depending on the camera distance.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was imagining. And it's little things like that. I think when you watch the video, you might have no idea that, you know, every shot had some manual tweaking or, you know, putting an edge selection on so that these three edges don't show up because we don't want them to. I guess from a technical perspective, what was the biggest challenge on this video?
Well, getting that look right was massive because I looked back at when the first render came out, the first pass of the first shot, and it was literally a month before we handed the video in. So we rendered the entire thing and lit it in a month, and it was easily like 2 months before that, I think, where we were doing the rest, you know, building the assets. And alongside all of that was just going back and forth, trying to get this look nailed. Once we had it in place, it was individual shots were just kind of your run of the mill problems that we would get, but it was getting to that place, I think, where we had to do a combination of Arnold building these rigs with custom espresso, like user data things, so that you could easily change the thickness. We also like hand painted lines on the faces and a lot of the clothes so that there was, you know, cheated it a little bit. So there were lines that would always be there because we knew that the geometry wouldn't really accurately draw them out in the renderer. I know there were a few technical issues with simulations and tune shading stuff that would be, you know, real par for the course stuff, like shattering the guys, because we were using this tune shading thing, you were getting intersections and stuff that you would never notice normally, you know.
Yeah, tune shading, it's just very finicky, but I mean the result is pretty amazing. I really encourage everybody to go watch it because it's really cool, and it's kind of this throwback look, like a kind of a modern take on a look that, you know, kind of feels like the 60s or something like that. I mean, this is really, really cool. This is a completely random question. At any point, did you get to meet Dave Grohl, like talk to him, or what's happening?
That's the one question I get every time.
I'm sure. Yeah.
Should we just not answer it?
What's he like?
We'll never tell.
Yeah. We're not allowed to. We're under NDA. I'm
sorry. Fair enough. Yeah, I get it.
No, we've never actually met the band because obviously there's a time issue. We're in Wales, so we're 8 hours behind the band, you know, who are in LA. And most of the time we're talking with the label and the management. And yeah, you just can't get rock stars out of bed before 9 o'clock in the morning. It just, you know, and he's too busy, you know, rocking out with Mick Jagger and stuff. So,
well, that's the thing, is like we're waiting for stuff from him, and it's like, you know, oh, we'll get a message off Dave today, someone says. And then you're like, I turn my Twitter on and he's like doing like 18 things. Like, when is he even finding time to look at at this thing?
And he's driving around with his mother and stuff doing a video. And you're like, and then the next he's with Mick Jagger, and then, you know, he was playing for the president in the inauguration. I think there was one point where we had a really late Zoom and the manager was like, oh, he's just texted me now, he might be on. But it didn't happen. But my wife's a super fan as well. So it's kind of lucky probably that he didn't come on.
That's so funny. Yeah. I mean, you know, Dave Grohl, I imagine, is kind of Superman and able to do 50 things at once. But it's incredible. So I want to talk just a couple more questions about the business end of all of this. I mean, artistically, I'm sure you and everybody at the studio are super proud of both videos. They look amazing. And they're just, it's so impressive to me that I think the most impressive thing, to be honest, is that you decided to become a studio that did character-driven pieces, and it worked. Yeah. I mean, it's just really, really cool. Now, on the business side, though, both of the videos, but especially Chasing Birds, very, very ambitious and lofty and tons of work. So I've heard from other people that do music videos that typically music videos are not profitable, or maybe they break even, mm-hmm. but this is the Foo Fighters, right? This is like a major, major rock band. You know, I'm sure they have higher budgets, but maybe you can talk in general, like for these videos, are these things that you're doing that actually are profitable for the studio, or are they done for other reasons?
Yeah. Yeah. It's definitely profitable. I can't disclose obviously the rate, but yeah, it's definitely profitable and but it is extremely ambitious. Like I said, the business isn't geared up to just be this, you know, profit hungry beast. The studio's, the main aspect of the studio is to kind of push the craft and the quality. Yep. And then the kind of the profit comes as like a secondary thing. Cause obviously if you want to draw in the biggest clients and the biggest stars, and you know, they want to come to you for a reason. So the studio is kind of geared towards outputting the best possible work we can. And obviously, there's timelines, there's things that just can't move. Like on the last one, it had to be released on 420. So there's things like that, you know, you're just going to kind of look at it. What can we do? How can we get these projects out? You know, one that looks amazing, that, you know, hits the time scales and we can actually physically do with the team that we have. Cause we have 10 full-time staff, and then we scale up to about 30 with freelance resource. So yeah, they are profitable, but yeah, they're not. It's not crazy money. You know, I'm not going to retire next week.
That's too bad. So no, that's what I mean. That's kind of that's basically what I expected. Although I'll say, like, the friends I have that have worked on music videos for bands that are many levels below the Foo Fighters in terms of like their sales and things like that. Mm-hmm. It seems like it's almost always, at best, break even. Certainly they're not making a profit, because even big bands may only have $10,000 for a video, which is not going to get you a 2-minute fully animated 3D film, I assume. Yeah. From Bomber Studio. So now both of these videos, you know, they look amazing. They're really cool and stylized, and probably the kinds of things that would be difficult to convince, say, Cadbury to let you do, right? Yeah. But now you have these things with the Foo Fighters name on it.
Yeah.
You know, and obviously you guys are doing PR around it and letting people know that you've done this. Does client work come from stuff like this?
I hope so, honestly. but yeah, we've had TVC commercials, which, you know, they have much bigger budgets for, that could be something like 8 seconds, 10 seconds worth of work, yeah. Not actual, you know, physical time, play time. So yeah, it's one of those ones where, you know, it's just a balance. We do a lot of stills campaigns. Again, they're a lot more lucrative than doing animation. If you want to do animation to make money, then I'd suggest maybe don't.
Yeah.
it's not something you're going to be driving a Lamborghini next week type of thing.
Right.
You need to do it if you're passionate about it, like we are. But yeah, we try to have this balance where we're doing animation. We love character animation, but obviously we take on other works like stills, TVCs. We'd love to do, you know, a few more TVCs would be great as well.
Yeah, I think that word balance really sticks out to me. You know, that's kind of the key. And I've noticed that in successful studios, they all seem to find the right balance of the work that pays the bills, mm-hmm. that maybe isn't, you know, as sexy, but then also these pieces that, you know, get hundreds of thousands or millions of views, are really cool looking, but they're not done to make money. You know, I mean,
yeah.
maybe mm-hmm. some of them do, but that's almost secondary. This has been really awesome. I have one more question for you, Emlyn, and mm-hmm. I mean, I think a lot of people listening have a goal at some point in their career. They would like to open an animation studio, mm-hmm. and maybe it's more focused on motion design, or maybe it's focused on sort of character work like you guys. But I think regardless, it's very impressive to open a studio and that studio still exists 5, 6, 7, 8 years later. What's the secret to that? And I've heard you in an interview somewhere when I was researching, you said cash flow.
yeah, that's
which I thought was funny. But so I'm curious, like what has, you know, kept the lights on, and what has made Bomper able to go the distance?
I think for us personally, we've been fortunate. Like I said, the way we started, it's all been organic. So, you know, we've not had any investors. We've not had anybody to, you know, have to have those five o'clock calls on a Friday to tell somebody they've not made a return this month. Or, you know, we've been really lucky to be able to just grow organically. There's been lots of help as well from the Welsh government. Have been amazing with certain schemes. And it's just getting your stuff out there as well. You're making sure you have good social media is key nowadays, it seems to be. It's hard work, honestly. It's really, really hard work. And it does take over your life, I'm not going to lie. I put a lot of time in. You know, you do your 9 to 5. It's really hard to get the work-life balance because it kind of consumes you. You want to kind of collaborate with people. You want to do cool stuff. And it's just, you're always thinking about how to push the business in certain directions. And one of the key things is make sure you put out the kind of work that you want to attract. That is probably one of the key ones that I learned in probably the second, third year.
I'd like to thank Emlyn and Josh for hanging out and sharing so many amazing insights about how they've gotten such cool opportunities and how they've been able to build up new skill sets in motion design. It's pretty easy to get pigeonholed in this industry, and it takes a lot of intention and willpower to overcome that and to branch out into new styles, and Bomper has managed to do just that. In fact, that makes them my hero. And I think we should watch them as they go. All right, that's enough out of me. And for the five of you that caught all of the Foo Fighters references, God bless you. Make sure to head to schoolofmotion.com to check out the show notes for this episode, and I will see you next time.